So that was Omar Dooley with the song Salgula. Hope I pronounced that right. Yeah, thank you, Afra. So you're still listening to Amandla. This is CKUT 90.3. We go now to an interview with author Jeremy Keenan. He is the author of several books on the Sahara, specifically looking at the Tuaregs. His most recent book is Dark Sahara, America's War on Terror in Africa. Jeremy Keenan is a research associate at the Department of Anthropology and Sociology of London's School of Oriental and African Studies. In London, Amandla contributor Nicolas Roux spoke to Keenan earlier this week about the secret Algerian connection with Gaddafi, the Tuareg banditry, and the plight of migrants in the midst of Arab revolutions.
We've seen that there's been a resurgence of protests in Egypt, and the war is still going on in Libya. So a few months on since the beginning of the so-called Arab Spring, where do you think this is all going?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. I think, as far as the situation in Libya is concerned, I think the interesting point here is if we go back to, 5 months ago, I can remember being on a panel. I think it was an Al Jazeera panel, and the main interviewer said that there were three or four of us on the panel said the same question: where is this going? And I think then, I mean, the response of all my fellow panelists was, oh, well, you know, Gaddafi will be out within a few days or a week or two, or, you know, in the very near future. And I wasn't happy to say that. I didn't say that. I sort of mumbled, rather saying, well, I wasn't so sure that, you know, I thought in the end he would get removed, but the end could be a long time. And I think at the time, this was 5 months ago, I think I said, you know, we could be, you know, having this situation almost like a stalemate for maybe 6 months or something like that. Well, that is where we are now. But the interesting question is, how has, in a sense, NATO misjudged this so much? Or to take the blame off NATO, how has this situation sort of arisen? By that, I mean, how has Gaddafi been able to, I would say, stay in power, but at least to stay in that part of Libya, to keep some sort of degree of control over Tripoli and the surrounding areas. And I think this raises one particular area of interest, particularly to me in my research, and that is the role of Algeria in this. And there's been an increasing amount of discussion, allegations, and of one sort or another, that Algeria has been supporting the Gaddafi regime. I should say there is no crystal clear evidence, that is evidence that would stand up to cross-examination in a court of law, of, you know, proof of what Algeria has been doing, but there is a vast amount of pretty strong evidence, which is becoming stronger as the days and the weeks go by, that Algeria has in fact been supporting Gaddafi in this way. And I suspect over the next, you know, weeks and months and future, much of that evidence will become clearer. And it's been, Algeria has been providing military support, fuel support, food supplies, diplomatic resources. It's been aiding in the ferrying in of snipers and all sorts of other activities. And this support, well, the question is, without that support, would Gaddafi have fallen? Well, we don't know. But the point is, the fact that he is still in position does owe something, and we probably don't know how much, but it does certainly owe something to the support from Algeria. And that is where we are now. That, of course, involves the question of what does NATO know about Algeria's support? What is it doing about Algeria's support? And where does Algeria and NATO move from here? By NATO, I'm referring particularly, of course, to the Americans, the British, and to a lesser extent, slightly in this context, the French.
You're saying so Algeria backs Libya, but the UK and the US, we know that they've been backing Algeria for quite a while. So aren't there some kind of contradictions in this situation?
Well, this is what we have. We have an absurd contradiction. A monstrous contradiction, if you like. And it's as follows. We have America, Britain, and France trying directly to overthrow Gaddafi, They may not like the word overthrow, but that is clearly what they were trying to do. At the same time, you have Britain and America. France is a little different on the Algerian context, but America and Britain both supporting the Algerian regime. So you have Britain and America supporting Algeria, Britain and America supporting the overthrow of Gaddafi, but it's Algeria that is playing a major role in keeping him in power. So you have a complete contradiction in North Africa. And this, of course, has now come to something of a head. Or it came to a head, let me see, sort of around the beginning of May and through into June. And I think it came to a head in May when some pretty strong evidence went to the European sort of powers, to NATO, to France, UK, and thing, of this Algerian involvement. And other reasons, other things were going on here as well in terms of internal Algerian politics. But basically, the Algerian DRS had meetings with senior officials in the French government and Americans and so forth. Britain really plays a very minor role in terms of these meetings. It's rather like the proverbial poodle, which, you know, is an unfortunate phrase now, but one we all understand, that a deal would be done. And the basis of this sort of deal, which involved Algeria's foreign minister going to Washington on May 1st, 2nd, discussions all through May, and then they became manifest on June the 2nd, I think it was, when the AFRICOM general, commander of AFRICOM, General Carter Ham, went to Algiers and made his famous sort of what I call one-eyed statement. The deal was basically along these lines. Algeria got a fairly strong sort of rap over the knuckles from the Americans and from European powers for helping Gaddafi. I don't think Algeria sort of sat down and took this like a sleeping lamb, because it kind of acts with its own sovereignty and more or less does its own thing. But there is this relationship. The deal was, as I understand it, that Algeria would desist. It would cease its support for its help for Gaddafi. It would also stop making an awful lot of sort of propaganda noises about the rebel forces being nothing more than sort of Al-Qaeda and being infiltrated by Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda was going to take over, etc., etc., etc. So America said, stop supporting Gaddafi, stop making these noises about Al-Qaeda in the east with the rebel forces, and in exchange for that, we will exonerate you. We will issue a denial, public denial, that there has been any support by Algeria for Gaddafi. We will point out that this is merely malicious rumor from Algeria's enemies like Morocco and various other organizations, and there is no truth in it. So on June the 2nd, we have a statement from General Carter Ham in Algiers saying, I can see no evidence. Well, he was looking with his eyes closed. Of course, the evidence is massive, but this is the deal that was done. So America exonerates Algeria, basically lies on its behalf. And part of that deal was that America would also support Algeria's claims that Al-Qaeda is strengthening, if you like, or receiving more and more arms and ammunition from Libya and strengthening its position around Algeria's southern border and was becoming an increasing threat to Algeria and Europe. So we get an awful lot of hype and propaganda and some truth about the strength of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, in the Sahelian states, particularly Mali, lesser extent Mauritania and Niger, and the threat being posed by this. And America is going along with this hype, with this exaggeration. In other words, the public image of Al-Qaeda is being shifted away from Benghazi, away from eastern Tripoli, where the Algerians were trying to hype things up, and it's being shifted to the Sahelian states south of Algeria and Algeria itself. There is some truth to that, but most of it is disinformation and it's hype and it's exaggeration. So we've got this very strange sort of situation. As you say, a complete contradiction. You have Britain and America both saying that Algeria is playing a wonderful role in its counterterrorism. It has full support from America and Britain. At the same time, it is making the Libyan situation extremely complex. And I should say that since that deal in June, there has been further evidence of support for Algeria supporting Gaddafi. In other words, if that deal, as I've explained it there, if it is true, and I'm 99% certain it is because it was made public, Algeria has already been breaking it, which is basically saying that Algeria really has very little respect for agreements with Western powers. It acts as a sovereign state and it can't be trusted, obviously, in this sort of sense. And the Western powers are fully aware of this and they can't do much about it. That is where we are at the moment, a very complex, messy situation.
Yeah, well, we've seen that the Western governments, they've been supporting oppressive regimes in the Arabic world. And to what extent do you think these revolts are related to that and consequently to the global war on terror doctrine?
Well, the two things are very closely related. That is the war on terror and the Arab Spring. The war on terror has involved basically increasing support, it was there before, of Western governments for Arab regimes, mostly of a dictatorial variety. That support has been in the form of giving them backing to fight terrorists. Terrorist means almost any form of opposition to that regime, so this has enabled these regimes, every single one without exception, there's not one exception here in the entire Arab world, to intensify its repression over its domestic populations. So what the war on terror has done has given, if you like, the reassurance to these regimes that they can repress their populations more and more and more, and the West will stand back and welcome this and will put it down to the war on terror. And Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, whoever we're talking about, can basically repress civil society and the various attempts at organization, democratic organization within these countries, and they can just be called terrorists and repression can be increased. So there's been a huge increase in repression in all of these countries under the name, the guise, the excuse, the pretext of the global war on terror. Without that, would there have been an Arab Spring sooner or later? I'm sure. But the point is that the increased repression in these countries has played a major part in, if you like, triggering the Arab Spring, which would have come about sooner or later, that's for sure. People aren't going to stay repressed forever. But there has been an intensification of repression over the last few years on behalf of the West. And one of the outcomes of that has been, you know, what we now call the Arab Spring.
And how strong do you think these counter-revolutionary forces are now?
I think they are quite strong. If we mean by counter-revolutionary those which are basically opposed to the full democratization of these countries, I don't think the West is particularly keen on that. It's frightened about where it may go. Certainly within these countries, the counter-revolutionary forces, such as the elements within the Algerian regime, are certainly helping mess up the transition process in Tunisia. So you've got assistance from elements within the Algerian regime to support, you know, counter-revolutionary elements within Tunisia. Egypt, the army is still pretty much full in control. So, you know, in many ways, not a great deal has yet changed there. Will it change? We can wait and see. Syria, counter-revolutionary elements there. The role of Saudi Arabia, is as a counter-revolutionary force is interesting. So I think, you know, the idea that some people may have had back in sort of February that all of these regimes would roll over and a wave of sort of open democracy would suddenly emerge in these countries and take over is going to be a very, very hard fought battle. There is no certainty that it will be won. If we look at Tunisia, okay, there are problems there. Hopefully they will move forward. If we look at Egypt, big question marks about what is going on there. If we look at Libya, well, we've discussed that already. That is stuck. Algeria, Morocco are trying to give the impression of making very slight reforms, you know, to get away with the minimal amount of reform as possible to maintain control. Syria is turning into a bloodbath. Nothing much has happened within Saudi. The Gulf states, Bahrain in particular, some rather nasty problems there. Yemen, likewise. It's, in my view, not half as optimistic as you might think, you know, in terms of what was behind the Arab Spring today, as people were thinking back in sort of February and March.
You're listening to an interview with author Jeremy Keenan, the author of a book on Africa. It's called A Dark Sahara. And we will have part two of this interview conducted by Nicolas Roux in just a second. That's El Tandura with Soft Shossi, and you are listening to Amandla on CKUT 90.3. We are listening to an interview conducted by Nicolas Roux, who spoke to author Jeremy Keenan, author of the book Dark Sahara. Here is more of that interview where Keenan speaks about the situation in Mali and the plight of migrants.
But it seems that Western governments don't fully understand what's really happening. There's been a dichotomy, dictatorship versus religious fundamentalism prevailing in the West for decades. But we've seen that populations there, they actually yearn for actual democracy. So do you think that Western governments really understand what's happening, that those populations can have real democracy?
I think the Western governments really stand accused of a massive failure of intelligence. By that I mean, I agree with what you're saying. They have failed to recognize, if you like, these fundamental forces within all of these countries, you know, wanting a more open democratic society and the sort of things that were, you know, coming up in sort of every. The reason why they have failed is because they have been absolutely preoccupied with the selling the global war on terror. They've been preoccupied with Islamism, Islamists, Al-Qaeda, the whole ideology that the West has been building up and selling, you know, trying to sell this package. And of course, they've been believing it themselves. If you tell enough lies and shout long enough, you'll believe your own lies. I'm not saying they're lies, but there's a huge amount of disinformation and propaganda in there, with the result that Western intelligence services have been preoccupied with Islamists and political Islam in these countries, and have failed to recognize the fundamental issues in these countries. So it's a failure of Western intelligence on a very large scale and on a very serious scale. Not for the first time, and I'm sure it won't be the last.
It's quite interesting, though, because you've said many times how poor the Western intelligence was, especially the UK and the French ones. Mm. But there's been quite a few reports, and I'm thinking especially a recent report by Europol that claimed that only 0.4% of terrorist acts since 2006 were from Islamic groups. And there's also been voices in the West confirming this report, and I'm thinking also of Laurence Amour. She's a consultant in international security issues. Mm. So there are voices that say that there aren't this many Islamic terrorist acts in the West. So how do you explain that the actions of Western intelligence are so poor then? Are they so desperate to sell the global war on terror rhetoric? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's going along with the rhetoric. I mean, if we strip down these intelligence services, they know full well that there is very little terrorist action in these countries. They know if we take just the whole of the Algerian complex and the Sahelian states, they know that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is actually really done very little in these areas. They know that most of its leaders are linked to the Algerian DRS and so on and so forth. And they actually know that terrorism in these areas is not really a major issue. But the rhetoric has built it up. So you've got the level of rhetoric, which has exaggerated these problems enormously. Underneath that, in the bowels of the White Hall or wherever else, you've got intelligence services which do actually have a better understanding of these, but the two aren't coming together. In other words, intelligence is really being gathered or manipulated to feed the rhetoric, the political rhetoric that's coming out in these countries. And that is what is so dangerous about this. And to a large extent, where do these two cross over? If we take British intelligence in Northwest Africa, what I know of it, I find it quite frightening. I think it really does believe the rhetoric. And yet, when I've had meetings with them, they say, no. Of course, we know the reality of the situation. So you've got members of the intelligence service, so on the one hand, claiming to know the truth, if you like, at the same time going along with the rhetoric and the lies, etc., at the political level. In other words, the intelligence services are, primarily responsible for the misleading political level. And this is very serious. It's a question of accountability, who's responsible for intelligence services, what is their role, and the interface, if you like, between the political and the intelligence levels. In France, this has been very problematic. I think it's problematic in the UK. In America, it's been extremely problematic. If we just take the conflict, if you like, between the Pentagon and the State Department, particularly during the Bush years, it's still bad, but maybe getting a little bit better. So it is. It's a serious problem. It's a serious issue. Mm.
And what has been the impact on the neighboring countries and the development in the Sahara in general? I'm thinking especially like Mali and Niger, countries that have also been enmeshed in the global war on terror rhetoric.
Massively damaging. One cannot, over-exaggerate this. The damage to these countries in terms of their economic welfare and well-being is huge. If we just take Mali alone, in fact, I can't quote the statistics to you because I haven't got them on my fingertips, but I think only this week the Mali government came out with a report saying the loss of income on tourism in the last 2 years was something like 80 million or billions, some huge figure. I mean, that is absolutely true. If we take the whole of northern Niger, well, most of Niger, whole of Niger, Mali, Mauritania, tourist income is virtually down to zero. That may not be a huge proportion of GDP, but it is a huge proportion of welfare and livelihoods because it's very labor intensive in the most underdeveloped areas and the poorer areas, particularly in the northern desert regions and so forth. The economies of local people in these areas are very heavily dependent on sort of tourism. I'm talking about all the areas north of Agadez in Niger, right up into the Kidal regions of Timbuktu regions in Mali, parts of Mauritania as well, even southern Algeria, which is manipulated by the Algerian government for quite different reasons. The loss of tourism income here is massive. Now, turn that around, not turn it around, move on from there. You've got the EU, for example, placing this region at the top of its security agenda in terms of saying this is a really serious problem in terms of security and development, and making available hundreds of millions of dollars of finance, money, for increasing development to improve the security situation. Well, we'll see where that goes. It's only just beginning. I have grave reservations over the ability of the EU to not only understand what's going on in the area, but to administer and handle this sort of huge influx of funding, which will more than likely finish up in all the wrong places. It usually does. The reason why I say this is that I actually was the author of the report commissioned by the EU on this subject. And I know that my report has been hugely redacted within EU circles. I would say roughly 60% of that report has been effectively removed within the EU, which they're entitled to do. It's their report. They can chop it up and do what they like with it. But I know they have done that. So in a sense, you've got a rather questionable situation arising in terms of the relationship of the EU to this problem. But to come back to your question, the problem is huge. It's very serious. Mm-hmm. The security of the area is now a major problem. It is a real difficulty in terms of, I don't like to use the word terrorism, but criminality, trafficking, okay, banditry, terrorism, instability. Add to that the huge problem of Libya, which is impacting on these regions enormously in terms of thousands and thousands of migrants coming back from these countries, from Libya, destitute, no more remittances coming back in. The figure for Chad I saw the other day was something like 57% of remittances have ceased. Well, those remittances make up a very large proportion of income in many of these poorer areas. To a lesser extent, the same in Niger and Mali. But many of these people, former Mali, Niger citizens, are returning home, disillusioned, cross, angry, without any money. Many of them are coming back with arms, and it is most likely that they will cause serious difficulties in these areas. They're going to be very stroppy, and one can't blame them. That's going to add to this very dangerous mix that we have in these areas. Those countries have major problems, and one doesn't see an immediate solution. Throwing money at them, particularly by the EU, in terms of all the problems of accountability and not really understanding what they're doing with it, is not necessarily going to help.
Sure. And what have been the implications for the Tuareg community? They've quite often been depicted as terrorists or at least helping Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So are they playing any role in these events?
Well, it's very dangerous and wrong to make generalizations about, the word the Tuareg community. Because there are many communities, many regions, there's a lot of diversity amongst them, et cetera, but if we do generalize, and just for the sake of talking about it now, the Tuareg have been much maligned. They have been accused by many parties of being involved with Al-Qaeda and moving into banditry and so on and so forth. There is a little bit of truth in this, insofar as the Tuareg themselves have been in a state of rebellion through much of 2007, 2008, 2009. The rebellions have not been properly resolved in terms of any formal, properly negotiated peace treaty. They rather fizzled out, leaving hundreds of young men disillusioned, cross, angry, no income, no prospects, no nothing, and just moving into what I would loosely call banditry. Some of that banditry has linked up in various ways with elements of Al-Qaeda, usually doing them favors, possibly working with them, protecting some of the drug trafficking, which is another network going through here. There is a complete failure of being able to provide any form of employment in these areas. What are these ex-rebels going to do? They are becoming a force in their own right. We've seen positive moves in Niger in the last couple of months with the new regime, that at least a couple of hundred of them have sort of turned themselves in and laid down their arms, at least for the moment. So there are hopeful signs there. Mali, the situation is difficult. The government is not really doing a great deal to help, but it's what can they do? So there's a lot of instability, a lot of difficulty. There's a lot of angst in the region. The Tuareg communities in all these areas are very worried. There's divisions within them between young and old. Young people in particular saying, what can we do? There are no jobs. Where's the future? What sort of prospects are there? Very inchoate and a very unstable sort of situation. But the Tuareg in general, and if we are to generalize over this, are very much the victims rather than the protagonists of this sort of problem. One might even say they're having to adapt to a chaotic situation as best they can. I think that probably sort of sums up their overall position.
We're almost out of time here, but I've got a last question for you. You're an anthropologist, so what role do you think anthropology can have in this type of situation?
What role can anthropology play? It's difficult. I think you could expand this question to many other parts of the world, because in many parts of the world we're seeing this type of situation. I think one thing the anthropologist can do is to be a witness to the truth. By that, we are usually in a fairly unique position, because we have, in a sense, a privileged access and understanding of the problems of local people, in a sense, to record, to document, to literally witness, and make sure that is well documented, the truth, whatever we mean by the truth, but as far as we can tell it, of what is actually sort of going on. And I think, it's very difficult to become an activist. I think an activist is very dangerous. One loses, in a sense, very often one's credibility as soon as one becomes an activist. But I think one can, and one has a responsibility to document, to bear witness, I think, really, is what we can do. And many of us are in a position in many parts of the world where we can bear witness to atrocities, to conflicts, to situations that are going on. We can't probably alter their course or intervene in them directly, but we can, as I say, bear witness. And I think that is something that we should do and we have to do.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for being with us. It's been a pleasure.
That's a pleasure. Thank you, Nicola.
And back to you in the studio.
And that was Nicolas Roux. As you just heard, he is based in London, and he interviewed author Jeremy Keenan, who is the author of Dark Sahara, America's War on Terror in the Sahara. Jeremy Keenan is a research associate at the Department of Anthropology and Sociology of London School of Oriental and African Studies. This is Amandla. We will be back in just right after this song with some analysis on the Dominique Strauss-Kahn story.
There's a son raised in the father's image. That's just amazing. Sean and Nicola Pukuti and Egypt 80. That's from the album, and that's the name of the album, From Africa with Fury. And it's called Slave Map. That's the fifth cut on that album. It's a great one. Well, it happened. It happened. Was it yesterday or this morning? There's been so much news between Libya and Layton and New York that this one almost slipped by. But Nafissatou Diallo's credibility was in doubt. as the procurer, what do they call them in the state? Prosecutor said that she was. They were just not able to believe her, that her credibility was seriously in question, and so they just couldn't go through with it. Our inability to believe the complainant beyond a reasonable doubt means, in good faith, that we could not ask a jury to do that. Assistant District Attorney Joan Iluzi Orban. Naughty. Naughty, naughty, Joan. You should never have said that. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, Nafissatou Diallo, the International Monetary Fund, of which he was the head, just to be clear, they've promoted the exploitation and rape of poor African countries through their control of their financial power for the last 30, 40 years. And so the rape of a poor black woman by the head of the IMF is really a metaphor for the relationships north-south and the rich-poor relationships that exist in this world of ours. So her credibility is in doubt. She apparently lied on her immigration application. Have you seen or undergone what it takes for an ordinary person from Africa to try to get into Europe or North America? Boatloads of people fleeing poverty and hopelessness are tossed up on the shores of Europe. But even worse than that, may die in the trying to escape. And those stories are common and frequent. Yes, she may have lied. I've helped refugees applying because the hoops to jump through are formidable. And what should she have done? Conditions at home are tragic. Let's remember September 2009, when Ghanaians demonstrated in protest against the lack of democracy and the terrible conditions of the people of Guinea. The elite, fine, no problem at all, they're doing just fine. But the people, the poor suffer. And you know, what do we get? The army in this country have been in power literally since independence. They round up the protesters and they corral about 100 of the women, and all of the army members present proceed one by one to gang rape these 100 women for their temerity. These women need to be taught a lesson. Contest authority, and it's masculinity you're after. You're really cunning. So rape is the punishment. Not one of those soldiers has been punished or even reproached. And as a daughter of Guinea flees to America and hope things will be better for her, the rules force her to say whatever has to be said to get through the refugee legal hoops. Gang rape? Yes, yes, sir. That's, yep, yep. Female circumcision? Yes, yep, yep. That's it. Yeah. Sing the song. Jump through the hoops. Then along comes Randy Dandy, Dominic Strauss-Kahn. In a porno dream scenario, he comes out of the bathroom in his all together at his fancy hotel to find the hotel maid black and clearly desirable. And he imposes himself on her. Ah, she must want it. Everyone knows the sexual appetite of the African woman is insatiable. Anytime, anywhere, or so the stereotype goes. No one ever speaks of the sexuality of the white male, especially ones that are rich and powerful. Randy bastards, from Henry VIII to Dominic Strauss-Kahn. Rich white men use their power and wealth to exploit women. The poorer the woman, the greater the abuse. But it's the poor black African hotel maid whose credibility is in doubt, not the randy white man. Money, power, prestige, they trump human rights, fair trial, justice, due process. Sorry, Nafissatou Diallo, I'm very sorry. There's no justice for women in Guinea. There's no justice for women in New York. If there's any small compensation, at least the smug randy bastard will not get to be president of France.